We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Duup and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time. Folks, I am joined by Mavs Draft, who is a good friend. His name is Richard, and he does excellent draft work. So I don't know if you guys follow him, but he's basically breaking down each and every prospect. He has great big boards. He runs great mock drafts with the overall draft Twitter community, and he's kind of a celeb in the draft world. So what's up, Rich? How you doing, man?
Hey, that's way too high a praise, but I appreciate it. I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm chilling, man. Enjoying this day off before we got to get back to work tomorrow. Seeing as there was no basketball going on tonight, I figured there'd be a lot of people awake and they'd want something to do. So I figured we'd talk about some random draft stuff, you know, not trying to keep it with any specific focus. Just want to talk about anything and everything. And I guess I can start it right off with, why do you think Cade Cunningham is going to drop to 10 and the Pelicans are going to be able to draft him? Any thoughts?
Hey, I'm just waiting for him to post an Instagram story, like photo, and just be like, unfinished business or something like that. Like, that'd be the greatest curveball in NBA history.
What would that even mean? He's going back to OK State?
Yeah, no, that'd be amazing. Or he goes to like the G League, like announces he's an assignment like the Ignite, something wild.
This is like when Zion was coming out of Duke and the Pelicans got the number one pick, and there was all these quote-unquote reports, and I put those in air quotes, right, because they're not factual in any sense. They're like, oh, well, Zion wants to go back to Duke, and he's thinking about going back to Duke, and blah, 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 blah. You know, right after the Pelicans got the number one pick, it was all that hoopla about Zion going back to Duke started. So I'm sure that poor Detroit fans are going to experience some of the same stuff in the next coming weeks. And I think everyone should just kind of, you know, just accept the fact that, hey, he's going first, and Detroit's going to have him for a very long time. That's going to be very good for their franchise in any sense. Do you agree that's the take, right? He's a consensus one, or do you think that he isn't quite the consensus and you're buying into these smoke screens that are been coming out of the combine and some other areas?
No, I mean, I've been saying for the last 7 months, like, Cade is a lock for number one. You can put him at like two on your big board and you're not, there's a good chance you won't be wrong, but like, nothing's changing now. Like, Jalen Green hype is real, but Cade's going number one.
I'm glad you brought up Jalen Green, because he's the prospect I have number two, and then I don't think you can go wrong with Mobley, right? I think for the longest time, basically up until the playoffs, I had Mobley as two. And I was like, nope, you're not going to move me off that. You're just not going to move me off that. And then the playoffs happened, and I watched all these amazing guards take over and shine. And I'm like, man, you know, I'm really concerned with the direction the game is going in today's NBA. And so if I'm looking at the ultimate overall ceilings, I think a primary initiator and scorer and a three-level scoring guy that Jalen Green projects to be and is, you know, at his top-end outcomes is a more useful player than what Mobley projects to be in his top-end outcomes, which is still a really, 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 really good franchise-changing talent, you know? I don't blame anyone that has Mobley at two, and, you know, I'm continually second-guessing myself on that. But where do you stand on that debate?
Yeah, so I'm actually the lowest on Jalen Green of, like, anybody on draft Twitter, and it's not even his fault. I have him six on my board. I'm ready to be just, like, absolutely get the pitchforks out. It's actually not a knock on him. I have pretty much the same tier of him, Suggs, Kuminga, and Booknight. I do have worries about the ball handling to an extent and using that athleticism because he is the best athlete in the class. And then I don't know how good he'll be defensively, but I also don't know how much of an issue that is. And I might just be overreading both of those things. So, I don't think it's even like, is that even a debate that he has a top three upside in this class? Like he might have the best upside in the class, right?
Right. No, I agree. And I think that's kind of why people have him as high as two, right. But I like that it took us to get, you know, only took us two picks before we got a little bit spicy on the draft board. So you said you had him at six. I'd like to hear the rest of your five.
Yeah, so it goes Mobley at two, obviously Cade one, Suggs at three. I'm pretty sold on him being that third prospect just because there's no way he fails, and he's still got a pretty good ceiling himself.
He's really good. He's a really good basketball player.
I've seen people put him at like seven, and I can't get there. I think he's the guy that like he's going to get a top 10 outcome. Like he's so safe, and I know that seven is top 10, but like he's going to be closer to three than to seven, you know? So I think he's going to be really good. And then Kuminga at four, I know that's a hot take. I believe his raw talent's real. And then five, I have Booknight because I think he's an instant, almost 20 points per game, going to be 20, 25 points per game in his prime. And seeing that Zach LaVine, Bradley Beal, they all go like those types of players, those guys go high in redrafts. I'm keeping him at five. And then, honestly, it's like 1A, 1B with him and Jalen Green. I'm pretty equal on him. It's just I put Booknight at five because I'm more confident in him, honestly, being better early, as weird as that is, given the talent and everything. I really do think if he had a full season of health at UConn, he would have been a lot more popular.
So let's talk about this Booknight and Jalen Green comp that you have. So first of all, I want to point out that apparently being high on Booknight is beyond awful and terrible. But secondly, I want to point out, you know, he is a little bit older of a prospect than Jalen Green. And so where do you see the separators between the two, and why do you have Booknight ahead of him?
Yeah, so one, I trust the pull-up shooting a lot more right now. And then also I think Booknight might be the best space creator in the draft, not named Trey Mann. And I think that has a lot of value. And I think he's more raw than people realize. He's not as polished, in which a guy who is not that polished, scoring 40 on a top 35 defense in Creighton this year, that's incredible. Like, that was a real flash. I really do think the injuries hurt his narrative. You know, he's not as playmaking heavy as he should be for someone his type, but I think that's something that'll be developed. And as he stops taking bad shots, because I think that was a UConn thing, not a Booknight thing, I think those passes and the assist numbers will go up.
The playmaking thing is interesting to me for prospects. And I think a lot of people maybe put too much weight in quote unquote poor playmakers at the college level. I think if you look at, you know, guys like Bradley Beal, guys like Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell, none of these guys were high assist guys. Even Devin Booker. And a lot of these guys, even beyond high assist guys, had more turnovers than assists. And, you know, like on, if you did a very superficial level basketball reference or sports reference search on them, you'd be like, man, these guys aren't like, you know, good playmaking prospects. And I think what happens is, as these players enter NBA systems, one, the game is different, right? Two, you just have more talent to get assists off of, right? You're passing to better teammates. And three, you know, I think the reads, you can teach players at least basic reads, right? You know, you may not be able to make them like anticipatory passers or like advantage creating passers, but it's not that difficult to drill in. You know, I say that it's not that difficult. I mean, these guys are elite athletes, so, but it's difficult for people like us. But, you know, for these guys, it's not that difficult to drill in, like, you know, like 300 reps per practice or more of like, oh, hey, I'm playing pick and roll against drop defense. Here is where the help is coming from. Oh, I'm going to like, this is the read I'm making. You know, like you can make it very formulaic. You can make it very algorithmic. Excuse my pronunciation.
You pulled it off. You pulled it off.
I'm ESL. I have an excuse. but yeah, I love throwing that in there, and I, you know, it's a great way to make people feel bad. but it's very formulaic, and you can get basic reads done, I think, with guys that have the ball handling and the scoring ability, right? Because a lot of times the defense is going to react to how they are scoring. And so, okay, if a guy can pull up as soon as he comes off a screen, well, the defense is going to react a certain way and certain passes are going to be available to that guy. If the defense is playing completely off him and dropping and they're trying to contain his drive, well, then, you know, another set of passes are available. So I think what ends up happening is that these guys, as they grow into their game as scorers, they grow into the game as passers. And so I do think with a lot of players at this age, the playmaking concerns are a little bit overstated, and specifically with Bouknight and Green, I think those two apply. Again, it all depends on how they develop as shooters, I think. And then you're right. Like, I think you mentioned you had concerns with Green's ball handling a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just think it's kind of loose and it can be improved to an extent. Like it's a little bit far away.
Do you think if, you know, I think OKC has six, right? So if Green is dropping to six, like they should be doing backflips.
Yes, they would. Let me make something clear. So I have Green six on my board because that's where I see him being like as of now. And I still might bump him above Bouknight. I'm still on the fence. Cause I give in to norms very easily. I do think though that like if he gets past three, one, shame on NBA GMs. Like I do think he should go three. As much as I do love Suggs, I think the top three should 100% be Cade Mobley and Green, because that's just my philosophy that if you're at the top of the draft, you should be going for the best upside in the class within a realistic range, right? Like, I think you actually were the one that kind of changed my mind fully, because I was like, yes, 75% of the time, you know, in most cases, I think you had published something on it. And I was like, yeah, you don't need to go for like good players. You want to go at the top of the draft, you go for the great players. Jalen Green under no circumstances should be anything worse than the third pick.
Yep. I think philosophically you're right there. And so I think that makes a pretty interesting board based off of like who actually has these picks, right? So I think with Houston, the debate is, okay, do we go with Mobley? Do we go with Green? How do they fit with Kevin Porter Jr.? Should you allow Kevin Porter Jr. to dictate your draft? In my opinion, no. I don't think, you know, Kevin Porter Jr. should dictate what you're doing with number two. I think you should just take who your organization feels like is going to be the best player. Do you vibe with that?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I'm so sorry. I just got sidetracked for a second. I'm terribly sorry. I just completely lost my train of thought. I had
no problem, dude.
I got a text. I'm so sorry. What was the last part you said? I'm terribly sorry.
Yeah, no. Do you think Kevin Porter Jr. should dictate?
That's what it was. Thank you. That triggered it. No. So, I mean, yes. Like, you do to an extent, because you don't, like, with someone, and I feel like, probably generalizing here, but I feel like he's kind of a hothead how he handled the Cleveland situation, which, like, was stupid. But also, like, there's a professional way to handle that. And, like, do you really want to piss him off and – who knows? That's an issue they have to work out. So I'm like, yes and no. But also,
look, as long as you're not moving his locker
He's not going to throw food at you. Or whatever it was. I mean, was it soup? J.R. Smith was soup. I don't know what he threw.
Yeah, I thought it was soup for both. I think I just put that into Kevin Porter too. But I guess the whole thing is like, does Houston actually have any cornerstones, or is Kevin Porter Jr. a cornerstone because he's on Houston right now? And that's like a hard thing to figure out. I lean towards he's probably a borderline cornerstone, but you're not going to – I don't think there's anybody in this draft that – like there's not anybody that he's better than at two.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think I lean more on the side that he's a cornerstone because Houston doesn't have a cornerstone, but maybe he can turn into that. I think you're definitely – you know, he's definitely one of those like, okay, you know, he's on his rookie scale – contract. You have two more years with him before you got to deal with any kind of contract decisions. Okay, what just happened? Yeah, sorry, my room started like glitching. Anywho, you got two more years before you have to make a contract decision on him, so you might as well ride it out and see if he can develop in that cornerstone guy, but it shouldn't prevent you from taking, you know, who you think is the best possible player. Two teams that really interest me are Orlando, which is your seven. Very interested to hear your thoughts on what they should do. And then Golden State, both have two picks. Orlando has 5 and 8, while Golden State has 7 and 14. Let's start with Orlando first, since you're the Orlando guy. And I would love to hear what your thoughts are at in how they should be approaching this.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for not calling me a Florida man. I meant a lot, but... but no, I think both picks, if they keep both, they should do one of two things. I mean, trade up to get 3 if 5 and 8 does it. Technically, that's, I think, what Dallas offered to get Luka Doncic just in two different years to Atlanta. I think it ended up being the 8th pick in 2019, but so that could do it. I'd be okay.
Who is a player you'd target?
If you move up, I mean, Jalen Green or Mobley, whichever one Houston doesn't take, you get their leftovers. I don't see Cleveland doing it though. I feel like that's a smokescreen that they're not. What? Why would they move out? But whole different story. To answer your question though, like, I think they go Kuminga at 5. I think they want that high upside point forward that can do. I mean, if you look at players like him, the wings that can do theoretically have the upside to do everything. That's the superstar mold in the league. And why would you pass up a chance of that? Even if it's like a 25% chance to hit it. The Magic are desperate for those swings, and if they hit on 8, the loss at 5 doesn't hurt too bad. So I think if you go two high upside swings without really overlapping where the roster is, you know, already kind of filling in at, like, it's hard to say, as high as I am on Book Night, it's hard to say that he would actually be a great fit there, because you have Cole Anthony, you have RJ Hampton, you have Markelle Fultz, and Markelle Fultz is probably the only true point guard. But even then, are you building around any of those players right now? And it's like this whole conundrum where – you have too many of similar guys, but the talent level might be different, even if they do the same roles. So I go back and forth. I think you should just do best player available regardless of position, but strategically. If you think Cole Anthony and Book Knight can exist, then do that in a heartbeat.
What would, so after Kuminga, who was like a second player you said you targeted like around the 8 spot?
I mean, Book Knight's the dream. I really do, as much as I'd love Moses Moody as a fit in Orlando, I would swing for the fences. I mean, you could start with Kai Jones, even though it's a little bit of a reach. You can go Şengün, who might be one of the best offensive prospects in the class. And then if we're looking at the Weltman type, Garuba could fit that. Or JT Thor, even.
Would you take Giddey as high as 8? Or for Orlando?
I know what I just said about not having a true point guard. I'm also lower on Giddey because I don't know, like – my whole thing is, like, I want these guys to all be able to be interchangeable with the other guards, right? Like, I want the point guard, if they take a point guard at 5 or 8, I want them to be able to play with Fultz. I want them to be able to play with Hampton or Anthony. But can you really – you can't play Giddey and Fultz together. Like, that is an absolute – you cannot do that because neither of them can really shoot. I don't think so, because not year one, which doesn't really matter. But if Giddey can't become a spot-up shooter, which even though I'm confident in that area that he will – I just don't know if him and Fultz can coexist. And that's a weird dynamic that may stunt Giddey's development. So that's why I'm a little bit wary of that.
It might not just be the Fultz component. It might also be the Jonathan Isaac can't shoot component. And, yeah, that's and it also depends a good on, point.
And, you know, he's probably, Isaac's probably going to have some on-ball responsibilities as he grows as a player. I don't think he's strictly, I don't think Orlando has plans for him being a strictly, like, play finisher type, you know, wing slash forward. I definitely think that they want to increase his on-ball reps. So, yeah, Giddey might be a weird fit there, especially if you're low on shooting, especially if you take Kuminga, who might be a question mark as a shooter as well. And so you're really, you know, potential is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, and yeah, it's tough. So I wanted the second team I wanted to talk about was Golden State, which might not even be a team worth talking about now that I think about it, because in my opinion they should just trade both of those picks along with whatever salary they have and or future picks and try to get better. So my question to you would be, do you see any like potential all-stars or quasi all-stars out there that they can cobble together the assets to acquire? And would you give up Wiseman in that process as well?
Yeah, like, yeah, no. There, I don't think anybody's untouchable. Like, you keep the core, what, three? Quay, Dre, and Steph. Like, you don't move any of those three. Everybody else should be available, right? Like, that's just bad business. Like, am I missing someone?
Wiggins. Micah Mulder.
Yeah. Two-way wigs. Yeah, no.
Smalzik.
One of the best shooters in the league. Yeah. No, I mean, I think everybody should be available outside of those three in every asset. If you're not doing that, it's just bad business. I don't know, though, who the best player they could get is. The very obvious target is Karl Anthony Towns, but I don't think it's enough. I don't think Minnesota.
I thought the obvious target was Ben Simmons.
That's a lot more obvious. I guess the way I'm looking at it is like someone who like hasn't been thrown under the bus yet.
Sure.
So like, I guess, you know, Kat isn't there, although he kind of has from the whole.
Can you imagine Minnesota trading back, like getting Wiggins in trading Karl Anthony Towns? Like what would, I just feel so bad for Minnesota
pick.
Fans. Right.
And
their own pick back. No, that would just, and you know, I think Alex Rodriguez at that point would immediately hit the relocate button. And I just do not wish that upon the Wolves. I hope they stay in Minnesota for a very long time. But yeah, no, I think that's interesting. For me, I think it's Simmons and then Siakam, which should be the two targets for them, centering around Wiggins and the draft picks or, you know, trying to make a three-team trade. So maybe it's CJ that the Sixers want, and then you're sending Wiggins and some whatever to Portland, and Portland can use any of the ancillary assets to improve on the edges, right? Because Wiggins, I mean, I don't think Wiggins is a better player than CJ, but that partnership with those two guards in Portland is breaking this year. I'm calling my shot. I don't think that's continuing, and so they're in for a different look. But Siakam, I think, would be interesting, and I think he definitely fits the Golden State MO. I don't think they're going to get necessarily better. Like, I don't think they're going to get a talented level player. And I think if they were in the conversation for one, they would be outbid.
Yeah. Is there anybody, I guess, I'm trying not to say it, but is there anybody on New Orleans that you would give up? Like, who's the best player you would give up for their package?
I mean, I wouldn't, right? So, I mean, I think from a strictly value-based proposition, if they offered Wiggins 7-14 future picks and Wiseman for Ingram and Adams, there's probably a trade in there that works value wise that from a pure rationale level would be dumb to say no to, but I don't think it makes sense for either teams to go down the route of figuring out where that line is. I mean, it probably makes sense for Golden State to do it more so than New Orleans. I don't think it makes sense for New Orleans to figure out, hey, how can we turn Brandon Ingram into Wiggins and a bunch of picks? Unless they know for a fact that those bunch of picks that they're getting Damian Lillard immediately, or they're getting Brad Beal immediately. You know what I mean? So I don't think I don't think New Orleans is like, yeah, let's figure out how we can turn Ingram into Wiggins.
Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I think Ingram gets enough Wiggins comps as it is. So they're trying to hold on to him and
wait,
him in a
better
situation. I think, well, I'm making a joke about how people call Ingram like Wiggins 2.0 sometimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear which name you said.
Yeah, no. I mean, if Golden State wants
the awesome Eric Bledsoe and then the super tough Steven Adams, I'm sure there's a Wiggins trade we can figure out. But other than that, I don't think they make for good trade partners. People say, you know, like, let's get Lonzo to Golden State. That ship has sailed. Golden State is hilariously into the tax, and any team that's that far into the tax isn't capable of receiving sign and trade players, because when you receive a sign and trade player, your team gets hard capped at the apron, which is about $4 million ish above the tax line. Golden State is like 20, 30 million over the tax line. So unless they're magically dumping Draymond Green or Andrew Wiggins into some cap space that, you know, a team has with their packages, they're not going to be able to receive a guy like Lonzo or anyone else for that matter in a sign and trade. So I think those two teams are off the table. The next team I want to move on to, since you've already brought it up, is the Pelicans at 10. Since there are a lot of Pelicans based listeners in this chat, I figured you'd have some interesting thoughts. One, you know, who do you like a lot in that range, and who do you like specifically for the?
So I'm going to start a little bit, I'm going to walk backwards here. So I'm going to talk through the team needs and then kind of diagnose it. So I have three hard things written out. I put high IQ basketball players, shooters, and physical front court players, which I guess Steven Adams kind of fits, but like someone who can do more than him. Is there anything else you would add? Because like the real need is just get players who can let Zion do what he does best, right? Like that's really what it comes down to. But like, is there anything tangible else that you would add to that? And then I'll answer your question.
I think they could do with more shot creation, whether that's self creation or creation for others. But I think you've hit the high level stuff. And I think, frankly, to be less specific, the Pelicans just need talent, period.
Yeah, which goes in with the Zion thing. So I think if you're looking at it that way, I think there's two, three, I mean, potentially four guys. It starts with Corey Kispert, the best shooter in the draft. You know, it may not be the best value at 10, but like the thing with that is, sure, his value isn't 10, but it's like also before 15. So like, you're not really making a hard reach. Like there's a very, very high chance that if he's healthy, he's going to be an all rookie member, one of the best shooters in the league. He's probably going to be comparable to Desmond Bane's rookie year, which every team in the league would have killed for. Then you could also put Trey Mann.
Okay, I want to push back here. I really do want to push back here because people talk about Desmond Bane's rookie year. So hold on, let me pull that up real quick. So I am speaking factually and not off the top. So Desmond Bane's rookie year, really good, 9.2 points a game, 3.1 rebounds, shot 43% from three on four attempts a game. I mean, like that is really good, right? That's as good as you can get. Overall, his warp for the season, I'm using warp because I did a whole study on how long it takes for rookies to start outproducing the average veteran minimum level player. His warp for the season was 0.4. His BPM was -1. So again, I don't think he was necessarily quote unquote like an impact player, but it's about as good as you can expect from a rookie. And so my pushback is I think people expect Kispert to come in and have an impact day one. And I challenge people, I challenge the listeners of this podcast or this room to find shooters similar to Kispert and prospects similar to Kispert in college and get back to me with their like first really good effective NBA year. So I'll name a few and you guys are welcome to do your own research. Tell me how good, you know, how long it took Nick Stauskas to get good. Tell me how long it took J.J. Redick to get good. Tell me how long it took Kyle Korver to get good. How about Joe Harris? How about Doug McDermott? How about Buddy Hield? And again, these aren't great comps one-on-one for Kispert, but these are all players that were really, really, really good in college. Like, really good in college. And so I think you have to ask yourself, is Kispert a better college player than they were? And B, are his skills tangibly, you know, are they more translatable than their skills for whatever reason, right? And you know, I can see an argument for them being so. I can see an argument for the game being a little bit more advanced than some of the older shooters like J.J. Redick and whatnot. And so it's easier to plug and play a guy like Kispert. But really, like, I just push back on the notion that just because a guy has one elite outlier level skill and he's an older player, he'll be ready to impact the game day one. I mean, I think Desmond Bane is as good as you're going to get, and he's not a needle mover statistically, right? He's good. He's in you know, he's a rotation player, but he's more of a back rotation player. And right. That's like the best case scenario. So, right. That was my random kiss word.
No. You're good. And I don't necessarily disagree. I think it's just a little bit of recency bias too, because Bane's been good. Cameron Johnson, he got, granted it was like pretty much the bubble and after, but potentially Kevin Herter too. Like, those are guys who they made their impact too.
But
so
even like Cam Johnson,
it's just like
in his second year, and he's 24 years old in the second year, again, yep. 9.6 points a game, shooting 34.9% from three, shot a lot better last year, 39%. Again, that's just like regular. And again, he also had a negative VPM this year. I hate being the nerd that brings up all these stats, but they're really like the only thing I have to look at historical level stuff that goes back like 20, 30 years, right? I don't have better stuff than that. But I mean, Cam Johnson clearly is better than his stats as you're seeing in the playoffs. He's a very useful player. But I again, it's just the whole thing of like, do you take that?
Yeah. And I guess it just comes down to like, do you want a rotation player year one who has, you know, he's probably not going to be a guy who like outside of maybe two or three games, because it even happened to Bane where like he really had most of the games he was positive, but there are games where it's like, man, if you could have just hit one shot, like the entire game swings. And it's like, I do think if you're just trying to upgrade your rotation year one and year two, because I mean, I do think by year three, Kispert will be a very useful player and get to that status, kind of like you said, because it is a big misconception. When you were saying it clicked. It doesn't happen in year one and two. Even Duncan Robinson didn't play in year one. Obviously, a little bit different, but like shooters actually, like now that you bring it up, it doesn't translate as quickly as it seems. So that is an interesting point. The second guy who I would put, you could say Trey Mann. I have him number 11. You said some space creation. I think he can play off ball well enough.
Spicy.
What was that?
I said, that's a spicy take. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all in on him. I said earlier, best space creator in the draft. So he has that on-ball, off-ball value. Doesn't really bring much defensively and not much of a playmaker, so it's kind of weird. But if you want someone to be able to run the bench, you know, when Zion or Ingram is out, where either of your primary scorers are out off the floor, it could work. And so, then the third – oh, sorry.
I'll sorry, yeah, before you move on to the next guy, before for listeners who aren't familiar with Trey Mann, what do you see just beyond space creation, right? What do you see as his calling card in the NBA, particularly in his like early years? And do you kind of have like a, you know, one or two comps that you can see him turning into down his career?
Yeah. So the names I wrote down were, he's very similar to a Tyrell Terry prospect, I think last year. Tyrell was a little bit more of an off ball player than Trey Mann was as a sophomore this year. But I think overall pretty similar as that offensive minded, you know, they can make some plays for others. They can shoot from pretty deep and they can create their shot. Lou Will just being that automatic microwave, some Devontae Graham in him. And then the other guy was Luke Kennard, but I don't think he runs a pick and roll nearly as well as Luke Kennard did or does to really get that. But the other things he does is I think he does play the passing lanes well. I like his finishing ability at the rim, despite mediocre numbers and not great length and needing to add strength. He has good scoops and other moves around the rim. I just see a pretty complete scoring guard with him.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Sorry, I was stuck on mute. No, I think that's those are interesting comps. Obviously, I think he's a little bit bigger than the first three you named, and with the Devontae Graham or Tyrell Terry and Lou Will. Like, is he a legit 6'5", or is he like 6'4"-ish?
Yeah, he's 6'4.5", I think, is what he measured at.
Sure, you know, so definitely bigger than those guys. A little bit harder to hunt on defense than those smaller microwave guards, but. Man, I think that's the highest I've seen him ranked, and I like that because you're going all in on shot creation. You're going all in on a guy who can shoot from 35 out. So that's the skill that's in these days. I like that. Sorry, I interrupted you for your third guy.
No, you're good. I was going to say the third is I had a hard time choosing a third. I'll just be real. The other one that just missed the cut was Jaden Springer. Or Keon, depending on who you like more, but I think I like Jaden more at this point. But I was going to say Kai Jones, if you want to go with that front court swing, but it feels like that's – I mean, would you go for a center again? You just drafted Jackson Hayes 2 years ago, who's still not even close to done developing.
No,
because he can shoot a little bit more, but I just – that would be the
like,
other guy.
That's I personally guy. Have Sengun as high as 8 in my board. Like I wouldn't be upset if the Pels took him, right? I just think it'd be really hard for the Pelicans to take another big like that. So yeah. I would like to avoid, especially Kai Jones being similar to Jackson in the sense that he's uber athletic, very fluid in his movements at his size, and flashes, you know, like the perimeter skills that kind of Jackson flashed as well, but comes with the same problems that Jackson has. So. I think doubling down on Jackson Hayes 2.0 would be a tough pill to swallow at 10.
Yeah, I can agree to that. It's too redundant.
So with the two Tennessee guards, talk to me about them. And I guess for listeners who might not be familiar with either of their games, what do you think separates one from the other? And and specifically, like, how would you differentiate their ceilings?
Yeah, I think Keon is probably the real higher upside guy, which they're close because Jaden, I think, is one of the youngest players in the draft, which definitely helps him. But I think the real thing for me is, like, Jaden Springer is a very good defender. They both are. I think Keon has stopper potential where, you know, like we hear about LeBron stopper. We hear about, you know, a lot of guys being labeled a player stopper. I think a true, like, about as true of a stopper in this class is Keon. Like, that's the guy. Now, the issue for him is that he's pretty raw. He needs to refine his shooting. Probably not going to be much of a shooter day one. He's an undersized wing. He's not really that much of a playmaker, in my opinion. But if everything comes together for him with his athleticism, I mean, you're really banking on the tools with him. You get a nice player. But Jaden, it's a little bit more. He's skill-based. He's strong. Can take guys into the post. Really unique guard. I think he's more all around than Keon is, where Keon's specialized and could be great at what he specializes in.
So two questions for you, two weird comps. They're not exactly similar, but weird comps. Who do you think was a better prospect or is a better prospect, Keon or Dante Exum? And then the second one is Keon or Chris Dunn. I guess of those three, how would you rank them as prospects?
It's hard, first of all, not to put in hindsight bias, but second, I loved Dante Exum in 2014. I was ready to buy the Magic jersey for him. So really hard. But I think if you look back now, knowing what we like, you know, with the scouting reports and seeing, hey, this is like what stuck, Dante Exum probably was the better prospect, being what 6'6", had more point guard skills. And even when he was healthy, he was actually a pretty good player. I would say Exum is probably the better player. And then Chris Dunn, man, that was the hardest evaluation I think I've ever had, because I remember, like, the defensive playmaking was just so ridiculous that I thought he could not fail. And then lo and behold, he's kind of failed. So, man, those are guys who probably are comparisons for him, and it worries me.
I'll throw in one more worrisome one.
Okay.
Frank Ntilikina.
Attack up here.
Frank Ntilikina.
Okay, no. It's a lot different, though, because Ntilikina, I think his – personally, I think his biggest thing is his mentality and overall just approach. I feel like – I can't tell a lot of times, but I feel like I can tell with him he's a soft dude. And, like, he's able – while he is good at what he does, he can be pushed off of what he's good at very easily. I don't see the same in Keon at all. I think Keon's a dog who is going to not give up, and he stands his ground.
Okay, that's fair. Okay, I like that. I'm lower on Keon, I think. I think it's mostly because there's a lot of things he needs to get right before he's successful. Obviously, the athleticism is going to translate. The defense is probably going to translate, but offensively speaking, he has a long way to go. And in the NBA, I think kind of like how we've seen with the players that I mentioned above is if your offense isn't there, you know, you could be all world on defense, and it becomes really hard to play you, right? I think the Marcus Smart is the kind of best case, like, okay, this guy's an all-world defender and his offense is good enough. And, you know, he's making enough shots, he's making enough open threes, his passing is actually sneakily good. And so he's good enough. But if you're not at least that level good on offense, like, you're probably not going to play. And so that's what makes it difficult. And if you think that, you know, he can get there offensively, like, then his ceiling is like a lot higher because of his physical tools. So he's interesting to me. I'm a little bit lower on him. I think I have him out of my lottery, but I'll have to double check. So I want to ask a few like fun questions, talking more like random skills and traits that people might have in the draft. And then I want to open it up to people in the crowd to ask us questions as well. So the first kind of question I have is, who are some of your favorite like downdraft shooters? Like, you know, like maybe late first round or just all across the second round, who are some players you're like, man, these guys can really shoot the ball. And
yeah, so pretty much anybody after 25. I think like pure shooters, I'll go with any shooter. Isaiah Livers is someone, senior, I think, out of Michigan. I think he was a senior, senior or junior. Really good shooter, really good rebounder. I don't see how he fails. I think he's 6'6", 6'7". DJ Stewart.
Why are people not higher on him? Isn't that the mold that the NBA has looked for? A guy that can, you know, maybe defend two or three positions, can rebound the ball, and can really shoot, not just hit open shots.
Yeah, no, he can shoot over defenses too. Like, he is quite literally the prototypical, like, three that I think teams have been looking for as a 3-and-D guy. Like, what are we missing? Because I personally, I don't know if you've seen something that stands out, but, like, he's going to be in condensed role from what he did in Michigan. And, like, he shot, listen to this, and catch and shoot, he was in the 86th percentile. Like, off the dribble, he wasn't that great, sure, but, like, he's not taking that. So what does it matter in the NBA? If he's going to be a pure catch-and-shoot guy and plays a solid defense, how is he not higher?
I don't know, man. That's someone I can see as, like, being the Desmond Bane of this draft. You know what I mean?
Yep. Another guy, if you don't mind me giving one more.
Dude, give me all of
Mario
them.
Mario Nakic. Okay, Mario Nakic, he's I think he's from – he plays in Belgium. I think he's from Croatia. Don't quote me on that, but he's somewhere in Southeast Europe. He shot 51% from three this year in the Belgian league. Not so great sample size, but we also pulled that card with Aaron Nesmith last year. So I feel like we're going to pull that again. And, you know,
I like that. Good comp.
They're not, like the thing with him though, is like, does a lot more. He does a lot more, a lot better. Like, he can put the ball on the floor. He's creative in getting and finishing at the rim. Like, he can attack. He can attack closeouts. He's got good blocking instincts, shot blocking instincts, and he has good basketball IQ. He rotates. You can tell he grew up playing in a pro league. So I like him as an upside guy that can shoot now.
Okay. I have two guys, three, two guys. No, three guys I want to ask you about. Three guys. Sorry, I'm going to cap it at three. The first one, and maybe he doesn't count as a downdraft guy. Maybe he's just firmly in the first round. Is Bones Highland? Does he not count as downdraft? You just have him way higher.
That's a good one. Honestly, I just completely overlooked him. I do have him technically in the range I listed. I think I was thinking so much of the 3-and-D type or the pure spot-up shooter, but he's so much more that it just escaped me. But he's a very good shooter too, one of the very best in the class.
Okay, and then between some of the more 3-and-D type people that we've mentioned, I'm going to name these two, and then along with the people that you've mentioned, where do you have them? And so the two are Sam Hauser and Joe Weiskamp.
Yeah, so I got Joe around the 50s. Still, he's probably one of the guys on the rise, and same with Hauser, because they are two of the very best shooters. And I wanted to list them. I kind of figured you would ask about them, to be honest, because they've gotten some rise and recognition lately. You look at Weiskamp, and he's got that kind of Duncan Robinson, the way he comes out of the handoffs and can just shoot those difficult shots over defenders. I think I saw something where he's like in the 90-something percentile on both guarded and unguarded catch-and-shoot situations. So that's a really good sign. He has a high release. Like, he can shoot over defenses. I just worry about – and I guess I say worry, but then there are guys like Duncan Robinson who it doesn't really matter. Like, he doesn't – I personally don't see him doing a lot else. And that's kind of my issue with Sam Hauser too, is if his shot isn't falling, what else is he doing? And I think something that gets lost with Duncan Robinson, because people always point to him, is he's actually a pretty decent passer. And he can recognize the same thing JJ Redick did this when he was coming out of dribble handoffs and teams would surround his jump shot. He couldn't make the right read and recognize the double team and everything like that. I'm still not sure Weiskamp can. And then for Hauser, his shot's a little bit slow. I might be overvaluing that. Or undervaluing.
That's fair. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm asking about these downdraft shooters because the Pelicans have 4 second-round picks. So I'm like, look, if you guys really, really like Corey Kispert, what if you just take 4 of these other guys instead of Corey Kispert and then, you know, take more of a swing? I'm just trying to appeal to the fan base here. But, but I mean, yeah, that was basically why I was asking those.
Well, and like just real quick, I know there was a poll yesterday or 2 days ago, something that said, would you rather have Corey Kispert at 10 or Weiskamp at 40? And Weiskamp at 41. But I disagreed, but I do think that is team dependent. What you just said is exactly why people probably voted Corey Kispert would not be the better pick, or excuse me, Weiskamp would be the better pick. Because if you have multiple picks, like if you're, I don't think, I'm trying to think of who doesn't have a pick in that range, right? Like, that's Golden State. They only have 7 and 14, right? They really don't have another chance, technically, to get another shooter down in the draft. So they would make a lot more sense. Whereas New Orleans, like you kind of said, you can take those swings in the second round. And I actually agree with you, despite, in theory, disagreeing.
Love it. That's what I'm here to do, man, to challenge. The second question I wanted to ask before we open it up to the crowd is, who are some of your favorite international prospects? And then I'm talking about guys that aren't, you know, projected in the lotto. Like, so not no Giddy, no Şengün, but.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll go back. Mario Nakic, love him. The Serbian, now that I got him correct, you already heard me talk about him. There's a few guys in the later parts. I have a little bit kind of trouble evaluating, but one I really like that I feel like has gotten zero draft coverage, and he's my guy. Every year I do this where I overhype a second-round pick, and he's probably this year's. I got confirmation pretty much unofficially, but it's about confirmation that he's not going to come over. But I've tweeted about him too much. Matthew Galzin from France, you probably seen me tweet about him before. He's a 6'4 combo guard, really good creator, needs to improve his jump shot, a good defender too. So has that star upside technically at 20 years old. There's Malcolm Kazalon out of he plays for a Serbian team. I never know how to say it, but Mega, I think, from France, 6'6 combo guard, can shoot, can defend a little bit. And then Filip Petrušev, who was at Gonzaga last year, played with Kazalon over in Serbia. He has really improved his jump shot, which is why I was so down on him last year, because he didn't have a jump shot, but he still has his little push shot like Rashawn Holmes's. And he's been able to really improve his passing too. So he's become a complete offensive player as a big.
Cool.
Love that. I am definitely not as familiar with the international class as you are. I think they definitely present difficult evaluation challenges, and me just being a draft casual, it's difficult for me to do so. So with that being said, I want to open it up to the crowd. I think there's been people already asking questions. Definitely want people to raise their hands and be able to have an opportunity to ask the questions on stage rather than just send them in. Oh, yep, we got Kurt. Let's go.
What's up, Kurt?
Hey, guys, what's up?
What? So I think this is my first time ever talking to you.
It's an awesome show. It is a fantastic back and forth here. And I have to ask, how would you react if your favorite team chose Jalen Johnson?
Love it. I knew you would ask that question, you being a Dookie. Personally, I like Jalen Johnson as a prospect. I know that there's a little bit of question marks surrounding him, especially with how he ended his high school career, how he ended his Duke career. I'm sure there's going to be like articles written about like, oh, we don't know if he's really invested in the game, all that kind of stuff. I get it. But I think he has a lot of talent, especially at, I think he's almost 6'10", right? I think at Combine, like, yep, he measured up pretty big. And so him being like the ball handler he is at 6'10", him being able to block shots and rebound, all the picture of him being like this closing lineup small ball five that can do all these things is really appealing, especially if you can get him into a development program that irons out his shot. I think there's a lot of basketball knowledge for him to pick up, and that's going to come with experience. But I love the idea of him. I'd be happy if the Pels.
Yeah, I personally would not be too happy if Orlando took a swing on him, just because that's not the team for him. And also, like, I'm very down on him as a prospect. I'm so sorry, Kurt. I was hoping you would ask about DJ Stewart.
All good.
I really thought you were going to ask about Stewart. I was hoping that's where you were going to go with it. But no, I mean, the biggest thing for me is, like, yeah, the off-court stuff, that's not my place to really comment, I don't feel like. There are question marks, but we don't know, like, as an intel thing. My worry for him is that I've noticed, like, well, first of all, let me just start with the positive, actually. He had the very best game of any prospect in this entire draft, like almost getting a 5x5 against Pittsburgh. And then the 2020 game or whatever, 2019 and 5x5 or something like that, where he was getting assists. Yeah, and even though it was Coppin State, like, who cares? Like, he still put that up. Like, if it was that easy, every top prospect would do it. So, like, the ceiling is ridiculous. But the floor is really low because he shoots on the way down, especially on moving jump shots. I'm not a fan of the jump shot just in any capacity. That really worries me, and I think that limits him a lot. And I don't know if y'all saw this at all, too, when watching him, but I felt like he was a little bit slow recognizing some open teammates at times, especially, like, in half court. Yeah. That was a worry for me too.
Yeah, there's definitely the processing issues that come with that. I think that is why you see such high highs and then some such low lows. And then, like, there's like, okay, is he failing to recognize these reads on defense, or is he just completely falling asleep, or does he not want it, like, or is he not trying? So there's that question mark of like what's going on the defensive end, because, like, again, he blocks a lot of shots. And can really cover some ground, but then a lot, you know, like, for large portions of the game, you're like, this dude is just complete negative because he's not in any kind of position to do anything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so he just is just out of it like a quarter of the time, and it is a very frustrating where he's just not, like, just he's just not engaged at all.
Right, and that's,
I'm not sure if it's like mentality or just knowledge.
Well, Kurt, that's kind of scary when you put that next to Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson, other Duke players who show a lot of, like, dude, what are you doing on defense? So maybe I need to take back my enthusiasm on the Pelicans drafting.
Although, so he is a fantastic transition player, which is perfect next to us. Zion, though. Always like that.
I agree. And I think that's what makes him appealing as a small ball five. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not entirely sure he'll work well, you know, as a four or a three, especially with Zion and Ingram. But if you're closing with him, right, and you're really, like, letting him grab and go and kind of play make in transition and making the game a little bit easier for him, yeah, I could definitely see the ceiling in that. What else you got for us, Kurt? And obviously to the crowd, if you guys have any speaking requests, just like raise your hand. We got you in here. This is free for all.
Okay, so I have to ask it. Is Johnny Juzang coming out, and would the L's target him as a flyer shooter at the end of the second?
Rich, you wanna handle that?
I'm strictly forbidden from talking about Johnny Juzang. I'm sure you've seen the tweets. A guy tried betting me $5,000 that Johnny Juzang would go first round, and unfortunately his account is suspended. I'll never get the money. But
damn.
Yeah, on a real note, I don't, someone's going to take him because recency bias is that strong, especially in the NCAA or NBA, excuse me, from the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. I don't like him as a prospect personally. So I'm not even going to say like, I don't see a team that could really maximize him, but maybe them, maybe the Pelicans with one of their last picks because he can shoot. But I just don't know what else he does at the NBA, especially as a combo guard or not combo guard, like shooting guard wing.
Yeah, I'm not a fan as well. I'm going to turn this question, since you brought up like NCAA success. How do you feel about Davion Mitchell, both of you guys, and what would be your reaction if your team? I mean, Kurt, you're a Lakers fan, so I don't care about what you do. Sorry, I mean, like him going at what? I think the Lakers have what do they have this year?
22
pick. 22. Yeah, I mean, I think him at 22 would be fine.
He's not faster.
Like he's small. That is my issue. Like Common Comp was the other Mitchell. And I just cannot see that because he's just so small in terms of height and its arms. He cannot attack the hoop like
the younger Mitchell.
Yeah. At all. It's not.
It's funny that the other Mitchell is younger. is he? I don't know. I think they're about the same age. But no. But yeah, Rich. Do you? What if Orlando got him at 8? Would you pull your hair out?
I'm not happy. I mean, although. Yeah, I probably wouldn't be too happy because, like, that's a win now move. That's a win now player. You don't. I Golden State takes him. Like, they're not a rebuilding team. They're a team that just didn't make the playoffs. You don't do that when you're in stage zero or stage one of a rebuild. I just don't feel like that's the move, unless you're. I don't know. Maybe they want to compete for playoffs next year with RJ Hampton as a rotation player, which I don't think is physically possible. As much as I love RJ. I don't think I'd be happy.
Do you buy his shooting, and what do you feel like his upside is?
So yes, because the form is nice. It's so weird that the free throw percentage isn't like he has no like I don't see anything crazy wrong with his jump shot. Like there's nothing that really stands out as like, you know, there's no clear cut flaw in it. I loved him. It's so funny because last year when I saw him at TCU, like I saw him against, you know, when he was with Baylor, obviously I really wondered why he didn't ever get draft coverage, being such a good defender and he could shoot. And even though he wasn't making it, he could take and, you know, make some difficult shots. But now that he got to 45%, I feel like he kind of got overhyped in that regard. Like, I think he could be near league average as a shooter. I just don't know what that value ends up being with that kind of role.
The other question related to him is, I've seen some people have Butler ranked higher than him. Who do you think is a better Baylor guard?
I go with Butler. The only question comes down to the heart issue. It's a very valid reason to have Mitchell higher, I think. But on court, I mean, Jared Butler has such a clear defined role where he's a 10-year veteran at the least. Mitchell very well could be too. But, I mean, you look at the guards, I mean, how do I word it? Like, he is going to automatically be a winning player. There's zero question about it. And he never won't be a winning player. I think I said that right.
I dig it. Yeah, I dig the response. Yeah. So we got Wolves Culture in here. What's up, Wolves? How you doing?
So I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm about to get flamed for my Minnesota comments, aren't I? From earlier.
About this Debian and other thing, I had Butler considerably higher on my board. Obviously, the heart condition is something I'm not considering because, as it is right now, I don't know if he's going to play basketball at a professional level ever again. But I think Butler is a much better shooter and a much better pick and roll ball handler, while being not much worse as a defender. But even then, it's guard defense. I don't really care about either of them because I don't think neither Davion nor Butler is going to be insane at a Marcus Smart level. So that's my reasoning.
I definitely have seen other people say similar things. Now, on the topic of both these guys, and this is questions to everyone, how much do you guys buy the he's a winner type evaluation that comes and gets attached to players that, you know, that make deep NCAA runs? Do you think it ends up making a meaningful difference in the NBA, or do you think it's like rather loosely applied to players and it's only, you know, a truly handful level of players who you can say that about, and they typically have to have an appropriate amount of skill as well for them to be, you know, have that kind of, like, I guess, locker room equity or whatnot?
I mean, so I can kind of see it for role players, like if they're a future role player, as in like a Tyus Jones type, but for a like lottery pick, it's just not a consideration at all of me, because oftentimes like the talent, like just like the talent levels are just not even close to the same. And the winning mentality for a star in college just is not the same at all.
That's a good take. I like that. I've always thought that it's been like, you know, you got to have the truly, you know, like I don't want to call them losers per se, but like, you know, it's like your bottom like 1% of players that like are more selfish and less team oriented that end up making a difference in the NBA. Like, okay, we don't want this, and they're bad, and we shouldn't, you know, draft them. And then it's like the, on the other end, it's like the top 1%, the Draymonds of the world, or like the Chris Pauls or whatever. Mm-hmm. And anyone else that is like, that falls between that other 98% of prospects, probably, you know, it's their game is more dependent than their intangibles.
All right, so I could be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure it's only two NBA All-Stars in the 2000s have led their teams to a college title, and it is Melo and Anthony Davis. That's it.
What? Dang, you're right. I was going to say Brandon Ingram, but he didn't win. That wasn't his year.
No. It was Ja for that one.
Dang.
And 2B DeAndre Hunter.
Oh, yep.
That's a good one. A little bit on there.
Or Kyle Guy, right?
Yeah, right. I guess, yeah, he was the most important player, but DeAndre was probably the best player on that team still.
Yeah.
What up, Patrick? How you doing?
Yeah, I was going to say a little bit on the college thing. So, like, it's always tough for me because I don't watch, like, a ton of film on any of these guys. But so, like, a lot of mine is slanted from my college watching, which is Virginia-based. So I was going to say just I've seen it sometimes attached to Virginia plays where it's like, oh, he went to Virginia, he can defend. It's not exactly the case. He can run the pack line against college competition is what that means. Like, no one is going to say that Kyle Guy or Ty Jerome is a great NBA-level defender, even though they were both parts of, like, the number one and two college defenses. So I think it's oftentimes really tough to extrapolate those more intangible things when the level of competition is so different. And I guess my question for you guys, because once again, as a Virginia guy, the guy I've seen rising a lot of draft boards that I just don't understand as much is Trey Murphy. Like, his shooting numbers like jump off the page, but from watching him, it's not a difficult shot profile. It's a lot of catch and shoot. He's not really a movement shooter. He's not creating off the dribble because his handle is, quite frankly, pretty bad. So, like, compared to other shooters like Weiskamp, who are doing more difficult shooting, like off of handoffs and things like that, I don't see why Trey has been shooting up the board as much.
I mean, I think it has to do with just the simplicity of 3 and D. Like, when people hear 3 and D, they literally think they're only doing you know, those two things. And that's, I think, why he slots into it. I'm kind of with you to an extent. I am lower on him because I, like I said earlier, it's like, what are you doing when your shot doesn't fall? Sure, he brings defense, but he has zero self-creation, which worries me. And then again, like, what if guys are making shots over him and his shot isn't falling, which is a very realistic combination. It's just how many times is that going to happen? And I think that's what it comes down to with him, is he hits a lot of catch and shoot shots, and generally his defense is good. So one way or the other, he's going to have a positive impact on one end of the floor most nights, and usually they'll overlap. I just don't know, you know, I kind of share that same issue. It's like, can't you find guys who do things better in similar roles?
Yeah.
And I say, yeah,
I think you guys have nailed it. I don't buy the lottery hype around him. Or, you know, even
wait.
In
there's lottery hype for him.
Yeah. Some people are trying to move him up to the lottery. I don't get that. I don't get it. You know, even in like 20s and below, I don't get that. Late 20s, first or like early second, you know, even in the second, he's the type of guy that you draft to play that role and that role specifically. And so, you know, like a team that has the 28th pick, asking him to come in and defend and hit open shots. Sure. You know, like I can see that. Right. And you can do a lot worse with that kind of profile, which again, we were talking about Isaiah Livers, which why isn't he higher? If Trey Murphy gets the hype, then why doesn't Livers get the hype? But yeah, I guess we've been on for about an hour and 7 minutes. I'm going to make one last call for anyone that has questions. Raise your hand. We'll get you in. Otherwise, you know, I think we're gonna wrap it up. Anyone in this current chat board have any weird draft questions? Shoot, we don't even got to limit it to the draft at this point. Like, what's on y'all mind? Who do y'all got winning the finals?
Yeah. Suns.
Suns.
I think that's too easy.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm also Suns draft. So right. It's okay.
Wow. Bucks.
But I'm going Bucks. Fine. I'm going to get the same Bucks.
Go Drew.
Yeah.
I think it'll, you know, obviously it'll come down to Giannis being healthy, right? If he can get in around game 2 or 3, it'll probably make a big difference. I think it's a minor miracle that he's even being considered. But yeah, I mean, cool. I guess if no one else got.
Hey, I'll give one good, I don't know if it's a good question or not, but one tough question. Next year's most improved player, who do you have? I can start if you want. I'll start with Miles Bridges. I know I just completely shoved everyone's answer out of the way for that.
Sure. I'll go with the hometown, not the hometown dude, but the Pels dude. I'll go with Nikhil Alexander-Walker. I think he'll get the scoring necessary to win the award.
We saw him in game 6, and it is Cam Reddish.
Wow.
Spicy.
Another Duke guy.
Well, what a
I didn't even realize. There. Of course, it's a Duke.
What a surprise!
I don't know if this is.
It works though.
I don't know if this is off the wall. Robert Williams.
That's a good one.
I like that.
That's a good one. I would go with either DeAndre Hunter or Garland.
I like those picks. I had Sexton as mine. I had Sexton as mine this year, and while I think he made he made good improvements, he wasn't as good as Randall. But yeah, Garland is a good one because again, I think what happens is a lot of these awards end up going to players who get a lot of opportunity to get shots up, and then you know the secondary thing is like team success. So I like Garland for that.
Sometimes I think that overachieves and the media doesn't really know who to give the credit to. So either the
Garland or
the improved player.
What about OG Anunoby?
He's got to be up there too. I mean,
maybe.
Who'd you say?
I don't see it. Maybe I don't see a ton of offensive improvement, and I already think he's a top 7 defender in the league. So, like, I don't know how much more.
It's just like what kind of jump can he take?
I mean, so I think Lowry potentially leaving can hurt him some, just in terms of his offense.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting what they do with 4, and that'll probably play into, you know, what kind of role OG has on offense, right? I think Suggs coming in, if I'm then I would just put Suggs next to Fred
day one and figure it out. I think they're all smart players, and he could. I think he'd fit right in. But if it's not Suggs, if Suggs goes before, then you know, I think either of Mobley and Green help a lot. But do you? I guess to close it off, do you see them going off the board and taking someone like Scotty Barnes or Kuminga or someone else?
I mean, no, I don't think they go Scotty Barnes. That's for sure. Kuminga could be though. Like he, like I think Kuminga could be made perfect there.
Cool. Well, I think I appreciate y'all for hopping in and talking with us, and I appreciate everyone for listening. We will push out the podcast version of this as soon as, I mean, not as soon as we get the file, but you know, when we get the file, which they've been hit and miss about, so hopefully we get it. But I appreciate y'all listening in late here on Monday.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.